Welcome to the Women Who Fights podcast. We empower female fighters to take full agency over their training. Our goal is to celebrate and inspire others with the incredible action women and allies are taking to level the playing field. We talk to experts, uncover prejudice, and champion what's driving our progress.
And today we have Lindsay with us. Lindsay is a functional sports nutritionist and has a master's in exercise and nutrition science. She's also a level 2 strength and conditioning coach and is a blue belt in BJJ. She has loads of experience in martial arts, but there's a big story that we want to explore. So Lindsay, why don't you talk us through, first of all, your martial arts journey, which I think is started at 14. So tell us all about it.
Yeah, that's right. So I started martial arts at 14. I was in school and we were doing like a self-development project, and I was going to go and do life-saving classes in the pool, but my friends were going to kickboxing. So I said, oh, I'll go with the girls. And therein started my love for kickboxing. I loved it. Still, it's my first love. I call it my first love. I do BJJ now, but I love kickboxing more. So I started training, and within a couple of years, I had gotten myself onto the Irish team. I had won the national championships and I started traveling around the world competing. I kept on doing that. It started to get difficult then. Back then, there wasn't a lot of females doing it. This was maybe 15 years ago or so. So I found it hard to get fights in Ireland, so I started taking boxing fights. I started going to taekwondo competitions and karate competitions just to stay busy between world championships and European championships. And I noticed that making weight, as I grew, making weight was getting harder. And then I got seeded as a teenager in a weight class that, as I grew, got harder and harder to make. But because I had a seeding, I wanted to keep making it. So I was experimenting then with making weight and looking at the research and stuff online. And then when I was 25, 26, I kind of had done all I wanted with kickboxing. There was nothing really I wanted to achieve that I hadn't. So I wanted a new martial arts challenge. I also kind of didn't really want people hitting me in the head, kicking me in the face much longer. So I wanted another martial art, and I decided it would be easy for me to go to, say, Thai boxing or something that I could just transfer skills to. But I wanted to start from scratch. So I took up jiu-jitsu. And I enjoyed that. I entered a few competitions and noticed that it didn't really excite me as much as kickboxing did. So then I joined an MMA gym, took a few MMA fights. Then I had a baby and I decided I couldn't give the time needed to train MMA to MMA with the family. So I went back to jiu-jitsu. And now that I've removed myself from wanting to be the best in the world at everything I do, I can enjoy jiu-jitsu for the art that it is. And I do really enjoy it.
Wow, there's so much to talk about. I mean, the first thing that comes in my mind is you took up a sport at 14 and you really shoot off. So how did that happen? Like, what, were you a talent that you did not know you were? Like, how did that happen?
Yeah, I don't know. I just was, I was sporty. I always done sports, and I'm kind of the type of person, my other half hates it, but I'm the type of person that if I take something up, I can become good at it. My dad kickboxed actually when I was very young, and I didn't realize until I started kickboxing, he told me that when I was a baby, he was kind of winding down. But I just loved it. So I kind of built my life around it. I was training as much as I could. And then there wasn't in Ireland very many women. The style that I did was called full contact. So exactly like boxing in a ring, except with kicks. So it was knockout. So there's a couple of styles of kickboxing. There's the more stop start style, the semi-contact. It's like karate. So you engage, the ref stops and awards a point to one side or the other side. And then there's what I did, which is ring, knockout, full contact kickboxing. So there just wasn't very many women. So in fairness, I didn't find it hard to win the national championships, but then internationally it was hard. And that's why I had to really jump into all the other sports to stay busy, to improve myself.
How did you do that? Were you literally doing like kickboxing and then karate and then just like, as in like training? So you're going between all of these different disciplines?
No, I wasn't training. I was just showing up at competitions. I was looking at the calendars of martial arts competitions thinking, where could I get some ring time or some mat time this weekend? And I was kind of treating them like spars. So Like, I went to many a taekwondo competition and just was eating people's foot the whole day, you know, like, because they're just so good with their legs. And then karate, I had a few, like, I went to one karate competition and they decided on the day that the women weren't allowed hit in the head, but the men were, you know, this type of stuff. It was just so, there wasn't that many women doing it back then, I guess.
And being a young martial artist, did your relationship with your body or and your confidence were these very, very good, at a very good place?
Yeah, well, this is I'm still trying to unpack this at the minute, because like, there was no body shame with me in that, you know, I knew I had to make weight and blah blah blah, and I was always in good shape because I was training hard. But what I actually had to do was defeminize myself, so because my worst case scenario was the boys in the club to see me as a girl, because then they wouldn't spar me correctly. So I needed to be seen as one of the lads. So even now in my adult life, I'm very conscious of, you know, I'll put a top on and I'll say, Dawson, this is very booby, and he'd be like, it's fine, you have boobs, you're a woman, you know. And so for me it was the opposite. I had to totally defeminize myself, and even if I was out, like in my civilian clothes, say with my hair brushed and makeup on, if I seen someone from the club, I'd avoid them because I really just didn't want them to see me as a woman. Because what happens is then they don't want to hit you, and then you don't get a realistic spar. Now, obviously, they're not hitting you full power. They're men, I'm a woman, but they still, something clicks in them and they won't. And then I'll go to the world championships and the girl is trying to take my head off and I have them in sparring well, you know. I actually used to find teenage boys were the best sparring partners because they weighed a similar weight to me and they weren't kind of, they didn't have man strength yet, but they kind of had the ego where they're like, I'm not going to let this girl beat me. So they're the perfect age for me to get in with, get a good spar from.
Absolutely. I mean, that's really interesting what you said there about defeminizing yourself. Was it because, like, one of the reasons, was it one of the reasons that you didn't want the guys at the gym to see you as sort of feminine and delicate? Or was it also because you wanted to project this sort of more macho, masculine energy just in general, because that was the field you were in, that was what seemed to be needed to be projected?
Yeah, it's something I'm working with a business coach at the minute, and she's talks about the feminine power and bringing that. Say if you look at a photo of the parliament, all the women in the photo are wearing black suits as well as the men, and it's unheard of that they'll just wear like a pink skirt suit and stuff like that. And it's where to get on the level playing field with the men, we're defeminizing ourselves, and we're just act like them, don't stand out from the crowd, and you'll get away with this. And that's incorrect, because our power is in our femininity, you know.
In what way? Can you talk us through that idea a little bit?
That we're the nurturing. So if you're in a boardroom, say, now this is just like car chats that I would normally have and probably not relevant to anybody, but if you're in a boardroom and there's a lot of men trying to make a decision, it's usually kind of more confrontational, you know, whereas if there's a woman or two or a lot more, it'll be like a roundabout way. There'll be emotive discussion, and then like the best solution will be arrived to generally by consensus. Whereas generally, I think in an all male situation, it's kind of alpha, you know, that they're like, he who speaks loudest and bangs hardest will get his point across. So I think in the world, there's a lot to be done with letting that feminine energy into these big decision making places and seeing how it does.
Do you think that sort of energy was really the more masculine energy for you was really helpful at that time? Is that something that looking back, you can see you really needed to embody?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, at the time. Because it was just me and a load of blokes, you know. Even when we travelled, there would be 10 to 12 males in all the male weight classes would be full, and then I'd be the only female in my weight class, you know. So it was good. Now, it served me well at the time, but now I can see, now that I'm not competing all the time, I need to unpack it as an adult and a mother of two and kind of a businesswoman, that, like, because my real passion is women, females in sports, and them getting what they need to reach their potential. So I need to allow myself to be feminine so they can allow themselves to be feminine.
Oh, that's a very good approach. Lindsay, what in that world of boxing, because it's way different to the world Shanti and I know, jiu-jitsu world, what's the We were talking about the derogatory language and jokes that aren't really jokes and that are a little bit offensive. What did you experience any of that in the boxing world growing up?
No, I don't think so. Like, I do remember one or two coaches just never knew how to deal with women, you know, and they just, but they were always curious rather than offensive, you know. Like, I had a boxing coach. I went to a boxing club and kind of outside of Dublin, and the coach would say, "Okay, lads, let's go." Oh, sorry, lads and ladies, you know, because when he'd see me there, and that was really sweet of him, but he had to change years and years of his programming, you know. And I was eventually saying to him, "I don't mind that you say lads, you don't have to address me every time," you know. But then you'd have comments like, "Oh, have you got your chest protector with you?" And there'd be like a half a little smile, you know, from some old man. And you're just like, "Oh, like," because they think, "Oh my God, you have to have a chest protector because you're a woman," even though men wore groin guards, you know. But mostly positive. But I think I was quite hardy. I wasn't sensitive. I grew up in an area that you couldn't really be sensitive. So I wouldn't like when I think about my daughter now, I wouldn't like her to be in those situations. But I think it's changed a lot. There's a lot more females in combat sports now, and it's become more normalised.
Definitely. I mean, having a daughter is almost really sort of, it must change, because you see it from a completely different point of view, because it's a tiny you, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah, yeah. Because I have a son, and he's 5, and like, I'm obviously trying to bring him up to be a nice man and to, you know, treat, like, at the minute we're reading books and he's like, he doesn't want to read the female characters because he reckons they're not cool. So I'm having that out with him, and then he's admitting that I'm cool, but other women aren't cool, you know. So I'm trying to that is just natural. That's not in this house because I'm strong. I'm, you know, we have a running joke in this house because Austin just does jiu-jitsu where I've done MMA and striking. So I'm like, I definitely beat you in a fight. Like, I'm the best fighter in the house, you know. So he's not in a house where that there's women are belittled at all. But yeah, when I had Veda, I remember I was like 3 or 4 days in and I was kind of just changing her nappy. And I just was like, I got so emotional, and Austin's like, "What's wrong?" And I was like, "We have a job on our hands. We're going to need to bring her up. She's going to have to self-advocate. She's going to have to not... She's going to be dealing with a world of middle-aged white fucking men, you know? It's like, we need to get this girl able for herself, and we need to give her every opportunity that she can. And, you know, Bodhi can be the example of a good man for her, but still, like, you know, it's a different prospect."
It is, because you've got to sort of create that environment. You've got to create a sort of a space where... out there this stuff might happen, but that doesn't mean it's okay. It's like, and you have space to sort of fight it, and you sort of, this is, you have to create your own identity, so take that outside. It's really hard. It's so difficult.
It is. It's everywhere, and it's oftentimes hard. As much as Austin is amazing and he's very aware of these things, but he's also a man, you know. He's so, sometimes I point things out to him and he's like, "Oh, I never thought of that," you know, that kind of way. So even to converse with him about it, sometimes it doesn't really get, you know,
Get home. Yeah, for sure. Can we talk a little bit about the self-experimentation you've done with your weight cutting over the years, and how you've, what you learned, and what was the process?
Yeah. So basically, as I said, I started I was in a seeded category. It was 56 kilos. And as I was growing into myself, it was getting harder and harder to make. So I started looking online, and I found there was a couple of like American wrestling websites, because I guess they've been making weight for years and years and years. And that was my first foray into kind of weight cuts, or sorry, into water loads and water cuts and stuff like that. But it was all so bad, and like, I'd done it and I had some good weigh-ins, but they were more so when I actually managed my food a bit better and just done a last little week beforehand. And then I had some terrible weigh-ins where I really messed it, and I kind of, say, drank too much water at the wrong time, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. So just experimenting on stuff that was all based on men, basically, you know, because when you look at... even water cuts for men, or sweats, or jumping in a sauna to sweat out a few kilos, like, they have at least 10% more body water than us, and that's just their body water. And then for every kilo of muscle they have, or every gram of muscle can hold 4 grams of water, so, and they would have about 20 to 30% more muscle than us, so they really have an ability to drop a lot of water very easily. And then, you know, so, and they also have an ability to drink water, you know. What it was like, drink 10 litres of water. There's nobody under 100 kilos that should ever be drinking 10 litres of water, male or female. I started looking at that, and then I kind of, whilst that was all happening, I was kind of starting to come out the other end of kickboxing. I remember one particularly bad wake up. I was in Norway at an invitational, and I had no access to a sauna or a bath, but the floor in the bathroom was heated, so I was on the floor in a sauna suit with 3 duvets over me trying to create some sort of set after being out running and not being able to manage to get on weight. It was terrible. I never want anybody else to be doing that stuff.
Absolutely.
You know?
So like, how did you manage to cut weight in a more sustainable, healthy way?
Yeah. So I figured out just manipulating carbohydrates and your gut content, and then how to do a water load actually correctly without hurting yourself. And also coming out the other side, because usually the harder weight cuts people have, the more the binge is on the other side. And then so you'd have a fighter that was, say, to make 56, or say we'll talk jiu-jitsu, so say to make 69 kilos in the gi, started at 72 and they cut down grand, and then they get back over the weekend, they're back up at 72 grand. Then you have someone that started at 75 and really had to restrict their food, train like crazy, restrict their fluids. So they're going to spend the weekend like what I call revenge eating. So they're, you know, they're binging more. And then so then their next cut starts a kilo heavier, and then their next cut starts a kilo heavier. And it's just really not good, you know.
And how many of those times did you have to account for your period or where you are on the menstrual cycle?
Yeah, at that time, I was on a contraceptive pill, so it wasn't really affecting at all. And luckily, I never missed a period. But even saying that, because when you're on a hormonal contraceptive, you're not actually getting a period. It's a breakthrough bleed that you're getting because you don't ovulate. But I was fine. But I did one time, I was in England at a box cup, and I had to weigh in 5 days in a row because I got to the final. So they had like multi-day weigh-ins. So I was fighting in the morning, and then I'd have a lunch, and then I'd go and start cutting weight for tomorrow. And it was just really bad. So when I got back then, I got really bloated and I was itchy. And my coach at the time said to me, you know, my strength coach was saying, itching is generally a sign of kidneys. I think you're after, you know, doing something to yourself. So go. I went, got blood tests. It was all fine, thankfully. But that was my wake up call, where I was like, OK, I'm not doing this anymore. This is, you know, because unfortunately what I'd done was, because I was so hard to get fights, I took late notice anything just to be busy. So I'd be like, sure, I can make that weight next weekend, or yeah, I'll go to England and do that box cup with you, no problem, you know, just to be in the ring to get the experience. But actually, that's a big thing I have with my fighters now. It's like, I can get you on weight, but are you going to perform? You know, you haven't won because you've made weight. You need to go and then perform. People are short-sighted.
Is that something you experienced then as well? Because that's a huge issue. It's like someone can cut weight, but then you see them and it looks like they're just wading through water with like a bag of bricks on their back, and they can't. They're just missing. It's like they're just their body's not okay. That's what it looks like.
Yeah, they can't. And I mean, your blood pressure would go low if you're quite dehydrated. So sometimes you see a fighter and they're stood up on the scale. This would be more MMA than jiu-jitsu, because obviously you've got the day before weigh-ins. They're like stood up on the scales and they'll get a bit dizzy, and it actually looks more dramatic than it is. And that's purely because they're a bit dehydrated and their salts are off and they've been stood up really quickly with low blood pressure. Normally fixed by sitting them back down, giving them some fluids, but still, it's not something that you want to be doing. But I see it with jiu-jitsu people, and it just makes no sense, because they've got to go from weigh-in onto the mat, and jiu-jitsu is such a glycogen dominant sport. You know, you need to be carb full, you need to be fluid full, your body water, your muscle, what's called your muscle tonicity. So basically, for you to contract your muscles, you have to have the right levels of salts and water flowing around your body. So if you've restricted your fluids, you literally won't be able to explode, and it's an explosive sport. And they think, I'll just get through the first fight and then I'll have X, Y, and Z. But when you're in that fight or flight subject, and this is a thing that distance athletes have, is your gut will kind of shut down, because it's like, we don't need to digest food now. We're in fight or flight here. So even they're trying to replenish while they're waiting for their second fight, the chances of it digesting are they're not great. You know, some will get in, obviously fluid will get in, but it's just, yeah, it all needs to be looked at. People need better strategies to get themselves on weight, whether it's a day before weigh-in. A multi-day weigh-ins are the worst. Same day weigh-in for jiu-jitsu, there's not much room to be messing with your weight. No. Really,
I mean, so for, let's say you are doing a weight cut with
like something like MMA where you can do a weight cut and then recover for the day.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of program can you, what changes would you make to like a stereotypical, maybe unmanaged or unresearched water load or cut, like sort of not necessarily the best way to cut weight? What changes do you tend to see, like general ones that will actually are just quite big game changers for people?
Yeah, well, just doing it personally for them, you know, and it's a big thing in even in the strength and conditioning world. The answer to most questions is it depends, but nobody wants to hear that, you know. But generally individualizing it to the person. So if you're coming to me at 60 kilos and we get your measurements and I figure out, okay, she's probably, if I can't see you physically and take your body fat, I can guess you'll be in around maybe 44 kilos of muscle, depending on how you're looking. So then I'll base your water load off of that, you know, and I'll base your calories and your calorie reduction off of that versus the 90 kilo guy in the gym telling you, like, just drink 5 liters of water all week and you'll be fine then in the sauna, mm-hmm. you know. And things like if you're in your high hormones, so like your 7 days before you get your period, adding in extra electrolytes helps with the water retention, with the salt regulation in the body. You know, so it just, but really the main thing is to, for if you're not working with someone, get to know your own cycle and know, you know, I bump up. Because I went into my thesis and I didn't actually expect there to be a difference, because I know from working with a lot of female athletes, generally if there is a bit of water retention, they'll sweat a bit easier. So it kind of just nulls itself out. Now, there's one or two that would be more difficult. But I do, what I do see is a lot of women coming in and they have early signs of red S syndrome. So I have to talk to them about getting a bit fatter and healing themselves. And, you know, these would generally be high achiever athletes, because they just can't help themselves to, they're training hard all the time and they won't just take any periods of downtime. They're doing binge restrict to make weight. So mm-hmm. it's a big journey with them.
That's really,
you know?
Interesting what you said about water, because I think with training, I used to just drink lots of water. And then I got to the point where I was drinking like at least, probably about 8 litres a day. I just constantly drinking water. And then I recently started having electrolytes, and my water just, like, now I feel like I drink a regular amount of water. And I had no idea that that would make a difference. Why does that, like, why is it that you need to do something like that in order to not have to, like, not to feel like you're constantly thirsty?
Yeah, well, basically, so your body water is not just water. It's made up of a combination of water and minerals. So you're looking at like salt, potassium, magnesium, stuff like that. So the mistake people make is they dehydrate themselves and then they just chug water to try and rehydrate, but you're not replacing the salts. And the same when you're sweating in jiu-jitsu. And people have different sweat weights and people have different levels of salt in their sweat, but you learn that by getting to know the person. But basically, when you're adding the electrolytes to your water, you're making the water work harder, you're making it efficient, your body has to do less work to get it to body water, you know, what you call it, the concentrations, to get the concentrations correct, you know.
Is that so?
I even have like my 86-year-old grandmother, I have her on electrolytes, you know, because she won't drink for us, she keeps getting kidney infections, so I'm like, put electrolytes in everything she drinks, and they've made a big difference.
Really, it helps with kidney infections? Why?
Yeah, just to keep everything. Yeah, well, with my 86-year-old grandmother, it's not something that I've done any study on other than that.
You know, you can see a difference. I can understand that.
Yeah.
Lindsay, you've done, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you've done a menstrual cycle and making weight research.
Yeah.
Didn't you? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I was doing my master's and I was really interested in actually seeing, was there a difference on the different weeks of the cycle making weight? My plan was to get about 8 of the girls from jiu-jitsu to do 4 different cuts for me on 4 different weeks of the cycle, but COVID meant that I wasn't allowed to do any in-person research. So I changed it to an online survey, which actually in the end worked out really well, because I had 465 participants, which was huge. I needed 320 to get 95% confidence interval. So for it to be a legit study based on the number of women that do jiu-jitsu. So I had 465 and it was telling. So the main things were, which I expected, was the 7 days leading up to the period and then the 7 days of the period. So starting on day one. So basically day 21 to 28 and 1 to 7, where people noticed the most difference. And the most things they complained about was bloating and water retention, and then appetite changes, and then having less energy to actually exercise a bit more to make weight. But it was really promising that about almost 80% weren't taking a hormonal contraceptive, so they were having a normal cycle, which was great to see. And then they really weren't cutting that much weight. They were all kind of mostly gradually dieting from more than 2 weeks out. Mm. And there was no difference between belts, which I was wondering, I was thinking, as you get up higher in the belts, do you get more sense about, I can't do this, I can't keep doing this to myself. But there was actually no difference between belts as to how much weight they cut and when they cut it. Mm-hmm.
Mm. When you work with athletes, do you have any tips for them when they're bloated and they have to go and compete, or when they feel crap and they have to go and compete?
Yeah. Well, the main thing, so what I would try to do is, with someone like that, the sooner someone comes to me, the better. If someone comes with a comp in 2 weeks and their period is due in 2 weeks, we're quite limited in what we can do, depending on how heavy they are. But if someone comes to me like 8 or 12 weeks out, or if it's a jiu-jitsu athlete that comes off season and they're coming up to a season of competitions, and we can mark out on the calendar period and competition, then we can figure stuff out. And what I would do is allow for, say they're on 2000 calories on this particular time, and then we were dropping it to 19 on that particular week, I'd leave them at 2000, and I'd allow for that in the other weeks, you know, that kind of way. And then I would do things like introduce supplements. So magnesium, 200 meg of magnesium a day has been shown to reduce bloating. Then you have like dandelion root tablets and tea that helps with water retention. You have your electrolytes that help with PMS. And there's some studies showing a phosphatidylserine complex also helps with kind of the emotional elements of PMS coming up to getting
okay,
the
period. Hang on. You need to tell us more about that one. The emotional bit.
Phosphatidylserine. So that's a supplement that helps manage your cortisol, which is your stress hormone. So basically, like your sex hormones, your thyroid hormones, and your stress hormones, they work in a triangle. And generally, if one of them is off, they're all off. And if you are very stressed all the time, so your cortisol has risen, it's going to steal somewhere else to make more cortisol. So it will take like the progesterone or something like that. And that will make your cycle a bit off. Or if you've had a month where you've not really been eating very well, you haven't been exercising as much as you normally do, your period might be off, your cycle might be off, you might get more symptoms than you usually would. So phosphatidylserine is just a supplement that helps your cortisol regulation, basically, and helps your body to just chill. Like, there's enough cortisol to go around, everybody relax, don't be getting stressed. And then there's things like, some people will have some genetic SNPs, and you'll only know by experimenting, like zinc. Some people they're not great with zinc, or they don't absorb it very well. And as soon as you get them on a good regime with some zinc, their PMS is just gone totally, and they can't believe it, you know.
I mean,
if you took every supplement that could be taken, you'd be taking about 90 a day. So it's about kind of getting to know your body, or me getting to know your body, and we try this, see how it goes, then we try that, you know.
It seems, I mean, I sometimes have this wonder why we need so many supplements when we're supposed to get stuff from our food, aren't we? Really, we should get all the nourishment we need. Yeah. Is it because that...
Yeah, food first,
is it definitely. Because people aren't able to get... They just aren't able to get enough nutrients from their food anymore? Or is it that... What is it about... What's changed?
It can be various things. A huge problem is the quality of the soil that our food has been grown in. That's not what it used to be when we got all of our nourishment from soil. But also, people back then weren't doing all this training, and they weren't living in this very stressful life. So you're already depleted. I mean, we get up, we're on to getting up, raises cortisol, have a coffee, raises cortisol, go do some training, raises cortisol, go to work, you know. So the people back then maybe were, they had a huge stress if the lion was chasing them, but then it was pretty chill after that, you know. So there's that, and then there's people's guts. They're not been looking after their guts, and like, you know, they used to say you are what you eat, but the reality is you are what you absorb. You can eat as well as you want, but if your gut's not absorbing it correctly, it's not getting where it needs to go. So a lot of people, so that's why I often talk to my clients about poo. I know we were talking about that, but if any changes in their schedule to...
I'm so glad you said poo.
in their toilet habits need to be noted. And that could be, sometimes I introduce more vegetables to people and they might actually clog up a bit and we need to figure that out. Or sometimes people, the opposite happens and they're just going all the time and it's unsustainable, or like it just, so then we need to look at healing their gut a little bit. But again, this is all totally ideal when I have a fighter that won't be cutting weight next week, you know.
Lindsay, I was thinking of a way to ask you things about pool in a very, you know, polite way, and how am I going to link it? So I'm so glad you brought it up. Can you tell us a little bit about, like, the poo business? So how, so what would be the ideal? And there's so many questions. Why do we, before the fight, why do we go and unload, like, every time before the fight? Tell us all you know.
So in an ideal world, you would be going once a day, just clearing yourself out, you know. But some people it'd be every second day, some people might be twice a day. But mainly anything outside of that needs to be looked at, and also any changes would be looked at, you know. So we might be having a reaction. Some people might have a bit of IBS, and say I'm telling them to eat loads of veg and they have too much fiber can cause actually problems for them. So we need to manage it a bit better and be very particular with the fibers we take in. With regards to, and then sorry, if someone starts under eating, they might stop pooing, and then that's a sign for me to look at their calories and see what they're doing. Just again with that low energy availability in mind, and the red S syndrome, and just even eating disorders, which are rampant as well with female weight making athletes. Before we fight, basically, I don't know if you've heard of the gut and psychology. It's like GAP, it's called. So basically, our gut makes a lot of our serotonin for our brain. So when you're under stress, your gut, your brain tells your gut, like, evacuate, because we're gonna have to do some stuff here now, you know. So that's what it is.
So can I just, let's say a lion's chasing you, and you're like, hang on, yes, exactly. I need the loo.
Yeah. Can I have a poo, please?
Give me a minute. Yeah. It won't take long.
So your body is like, I'm going to have to sprint here, so I need to evacuate all bodily fluids instantly, and then I'll be lighter, and then I'll run faster, and then I won't have to stop for a poo. So you know, you hear like women when they go into labor, they'll vomit or they'll poo, and it's their body's just clearing out for this huge physical feat that they have to do now. So you literally, what I call, I don't know how PG this is, but I call that my pre-fight shite. And then when I'm talking to clients and they're like, oh, I'm in my ghee, but I'm 200 grams over. I'm like, have you had your pre-fight shite? They're like, no. I'm like, you'll be fine.
Don't worry. Everything's under control.
Yeah. Your body will do you a solid now.
Was that study you did with the making weight, the survey, was that the only one of that kind have you done? Or have you done any other sorts of studies like that?
No, that was the first one, yeah. So basically, and what I found was it was literally the first one on females making weight for sport, like that exists. It's outrageous, yeah. So what I had to do, so I was trying to figure out, I was trying to do this study, but I had to try and find other studies to make the rationale for the study, and I had to just check what the research was, and there was literally zero studies entirely on females making weight for any sport. So even jockeys, lightweight rowers or sailors, or and so there was a few studies on injuries at certain times of the month, but there was nothing. So then what I had to do was go into endocrinology studies and look at what they done on bloating or what they done on hormone dysregulation and pull them in. So I had to synergize it. I had to go, okay, bloating, and then look at studies for that. Then I had to look at appetite changes, look at studies for that, energy and hormones, and look at studies for that, and pull them all together. And then I had to go and look at martial arts studies, making weight studies, and pull them in and find actually how many women were there in this study and is it relevant. So it was quite the trek, actually. But yeah, it's amazing that, because I mean, I think it was in the 60s that the Olympic Committee started looking at females and high-level female athletes having some menstrual dysfunction based on training very heavy. So it was Tokyo in 1962? The Tokyo Olympics was the first one where the female participation was like 13%, and that was huge back then. So they started, the Olympic Committee started looking then at stuff because women were reporting having troubles. They weren't getting their period and stuff when they were training for the Olympics. So these studies have been going on for 60 years, but no one has touched on females that have to make weight for sport. So they're telling you, you know, to not have like red S syndrome, which is like a kind of a, you start getting trouble like with bone mineral density, you lose your period, you cardiac issues, mood regulation, that type of stuff. So they haven't looked at that. So the thing for them is to train less and eat a bit more, and you know, don't be in too much of a calorie deficit too often. Don't do cyclical reductions and increases, reduction and increase. But that's not feasible for females that make weight. Like for jiu-jitsu, like, you know, an MMA fighter maybe can plan 2 fights a year this month and this month, but the jiu-jitsu calendar is year-round. There's no season. It's like kickboxing. There's no kind of season as such. So they're making weight regularly. So it really needs to be studied.
So you recently, I mean, how easy was it for you to study out the to carry out the research? Was there any pushback for what you did or your proposal?
Not pushback. I think people were interested in it, but I had to do I had to propose it to 2 men who have never done a martial art in their life or even didn't know what a water cut was. And I mean, amazing researchers, both PhDs and running the course, and you know, but some of the questions they asked, I was just like, but then of course they don't understand cutting. What? Why the hell would you dehydrate yourself? You know. So when I done the proposal initially, I was talking about doing it physically with the girls. So I was talking about putting them in the bath for like 20 minutes, taking them out, doing a wrap and weighing them before the bath and after the bath. And that was how we would decide on the different weeks of the period what the difference was, if there was any. And he was like, one of the questions was like, well, how do you know it was water that they lost? And I was just like, well, they're not going to be eating anything while they're in the bath. And I hope they're not going to the loo while they're in the bath. So what else could it be that they lose, you know? But for him, it was just like, you're going to, what? You know, but so just them not understanding, and then that made me question. I was saying, is this stupid? Am I going to fail my master's now with this? You know, but I knew, I was like, man, I've done this a million times. We know, and the women need to know. And even when I put out the survey, the amount of people that took part, and so many people mailed me privately saying, please send me on your results. This is well needed. I'm dying to hear how this goes. You know,
wow. And has there been anything since? Any other studies into that?
No, well, at the minute that we're getting it published in the European Journal of Sports Science, so I've had to pull it in too. So that initial research I was telling you I'd done, where I pulled all of the other reports on all the symptoms, it's going to be one article, and then my own survey based research is going to be another article. So hopefully when that comes out, then that will open the doors for me to then look into it further, you know.
That's very big, I think. And are you going to keep doing that?
Yeah, definitely. For females, one of my pet peeves is like females that think their period is an inconvenience, and they're like, oh Jesus, I have my period and fight week and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, your period is literally your body's report card on how you've done this month, how you are health-wise, you know.
And you just don't want it when you're competing, that report card. You're like, not now, report me later.
Yeah, I don't need any bad news till tomorrow. Yeah, but it's just to put in procedures in place, and even just knowing that you're miserable when you get your period, if you know that going into comp week, that should help you. Like, no, I've been miserable when I'm having my period. Maybe I need to up my zinc and my magnesium and see how that goes. But it's the attitude that it doesn't matter if I'm not getting a period because I'm not trying to have babies right now. And it's so short-sighted, because you're looking into, you know, brittle bones, increased risk of stroke later in life, you know, heart problems. There's so much more to what your sex hormones do outside of reproducing, you know.
Are you talking about red S, or are you talking about like contraceptive pills when you're saying?
Oh, amenorrhea.
Amenorrhea.
Amenorrhea, okay. Basically.
Amenorrhea.
Yes, so if people are having that hypothalamic, so it's basically based on low energy and high exercise, that's just really poor for their health long term, you know.
And What is improved grappling? Can you tell us a little who started it, what it is, and all of that?
Yeah, so this is my other baby. So I have the female fight nutritionist, which is all about periods and getting females on weight without hurting themselves. And then improve. So that was Austin and I, my other half, were thinking about that. So basically, we are both passionate about strength and conditioning for athletes, and it's just so poorly done. And when I started jiu-jitsu, I noticed I was going to competitions and I was watching, and a lot of the girls, like, I was thinking, Jesus, if their glutes were just stronger, they'd have, you know, that hip escape would have really worked, or, you know, if they could explode here. So I really seen a gap in women not lifting. Now it's for men and women, but that was where my passion came into it. And I talked to Austin about it, and we were trying to work with athletes, but we're personal trainers trying to make a living. So we can't have 100 athletes in and only charging them mates rates. Like, we need to pay our rent and feed our children. So we were thinking, how can we get good S&C out there for people? And then we were looking at the likes of, you know, yoga for BJJ. So they were doing, you know, that's kind of subscription service model. And we were thinking, like, jiu-jitsu kind of needs this. And it's not, we haven't reinvented the wheel, but what we're doing is we're structuring your program so it will benefit your jiu-jitsu. We're pointing out to you, like, you know, we're not doing one-legged Bozu ball squats with, like, hammer on your head. It's the fundamentals and strength and conditioning always work, but it's pointing out to the athlete, this is where this helps your jiu-jitsu, this is good for your jiu-jitsu. And then mainly jiu-jitsu injuries that are very common, like shoulders and knees, low backs, you know, looking at them and strengthening up them and undoing the imbalance you would have by repetitive use of them in one angle on the mats, trying to strengthen them up in the other angle outside of the mats. So that's where that came from.
So do you do it online or is it in person?
Yeah. No, so it's online. It's a subscription service. So basically you sign up and then you choose your goal. So it might be like fat loss, gaining strength, building muscle, and then it will direct you to your program, and then your program changes every month. And then there's like 1 day programs there for if you're doing any extra. There's a lot of rehab programs or injury prevention programs on there. So basically what we tried to do was, like, so you know you use Netflix, for example, but you could download any movie you wanted to, but Netflix is so easy, it's there in front of you. And strength training is the same in that everything's on YouTube for free, but nobody's actually structured it and made it progressive for you. So with improved grappling, you come in, you get your specific program, and then next month the program you get will be based on what you did last month, and then next month it will be based on what you did last. So it's all very structured, and that's where you get the progress from.
Wow. And do you predominantly work with women or do you work with anyone?
Me, I in the gym physically, anyone, but I'm fully booked, so it's mainly women. I just seem to attract women. It's probably because of my rants about women and women's health. And then nutrition wise, like for a female fight nutritionist, yeah, it's women. But I have worked with men, but men are so easy. Men have no hormonal, like, you tell a man eat these many calories, this many carbohydrates, this many protein, he goes and does it and he loses the weight you wanted him to. It's so straightforward. So I almost feel like we shouldn't be charging men, to be honest.
It is, and that's complicated, I guess. Would that often be because obviously every woman needs something slightly different for their physiology in terms of what's going on, but is it also because a lot of women might have some underlying something that's not quite right, so then it's actually a case of healing? Absolutely. Or something first?
Absolutely, yeah. So generally there's no woman that comes to me having not been done some sort of like bad dieting in the past, you know, some like disordered eating, not an eating disorder, but some sort of disordered eating. So they're coming to me with some sort of a problem that we need to dance around. And then sometimes I've turned down working with fighters because I feel like they actually, it's not good what they're doing and they need to step away and get better before they cut weight, or if they won't agree to go up a weight category. You know, I've had some high profile people contact me on fight week, way overweight, and I've just said, no, you know, it's just not, I can't be, it's just not good, you know, people die, you know.
Wow. I mean, they must know that, though. They must know that. They must, like, they must be like in a situation where they've just made a massive error. To then be coming to someone like you in fight week, they must just be like absolute panicking because what? Absolutely, maybe
they're just trying everything. Yeah. But what's happened usually with that person is that it's been, I used to be able to make weight this easy. So I used to be able to start 3 weeks out and just diet and I'd be on weight. And then the last camp, I done that and I really had to struggle to make weight. And this camp, I started 3 weeks out and I haven't lost any weight. And it's all just red flags, red flags, red flags, you know. Or sometimes people get complacent, they have an easy weight cut so they don't start till too late and then their body doesn't react, you know. Because we're females and like if you start dieting in week one of your cycle versus week three of your cycle, your body might react differently, you know. Like I know personally with me, my body takes 2 weeks to get on board with what I'm doing. So I'll be dieting for 2 weeks and there'll be no change. And then suddenly my body will be like, oh, we're dieting. Great. Okay.
But Lindsay, when you work with someone, how well in advance do you want to work with them in order to put a plan in place? Because I suspect when you're working with an MMA athlete, let's say, mm-hmm. you might want to know how their body reacts. So what's the ideal duration?
Yeah, like, I mean, I would want, depending on how far outside of their fighting weight category they are, an ideal world, someone would give me 12 weeks. In a medium world, it would be 8 weeks. Anything less than 8 weeks is really, really tough going, you know? Like, I worked with Ash Daly for UFC Dublin when the UFC was in Dublin years ago when she was fighting. And she was working with a very reputable nutritionist. And unfortunately, he just hadn't worked with many women. He was brilliant with the rest of the male team. And Ash hadn't had a period. And she won't mind me saying, we've talked about it before, but she hadn't had a period. And she thought that was totally normal because she was an athlete. And I actually wound up, she called me in for sparring 3 weeks before UFC Dublin. And we just kind of got chatting about nutrition. And I, like, he had her, like, this is someone that was training twice or three times a day and she was eating 1,200 calories. And I'm not a good liar, so I couldn't, when she told me that, I couldn't. And she was saying, well, what do you think of that? And I said, no, it's terrible. But then she contacted me the next day and she's like, would you take over my cup? But because it was only 3 weeks out, I actually couldn't increase her calories. So what I had to do was increase the mass of food she was getting with the 1,200 calories. So just entirely fill her plate with vegetables and stuff like that because they haven't got much calories, and then get her some good oily red meats, oily fish. And then she got on weight. But, you know, that's tough going. And that's an athlete that's just been doing what's asked of them for the past 8 weeks, but just getting bad information. And I really hate that, you know, because generally female athletes in particular, except ones that maybe have a bit of disordered eating, but mainly they will do what you ask, especially if they're high achievers, because they see this as the tool that gives them the edge. And nobody wants to do a bad weight cut. Nobody wants to be going to the IBJJF, paying €1,000 to go to the competition and worried about weighing in when they get there.
Absolutely.
You know?
I mean, it seems to be quite trying to find someone with your sort of skill set, knowledge. It's mm-hmm. hard to find. And I think it's hard to find as well, like women who, like someone who's done the sport and has been through it, because the only way, someone who's studied at a university and then come out the other end and they've never actually physically experienced it, it's just, it's a very different depth of knowledge. And so it doesn't feel like it's just much more, it's much harder to find. So I think it feels like a lot of athletes just, it's just not in front of them. And until they find someone like you, that they just deal with it.
Yeah, I know. And this is the thing. They just feel like they immediately feel a kinship towards me because they're like, she's been there. She's done it. She knows how I feel. So when they're texting me, you know, complaining, I'm like, I know. But, you know, you're nearly there or whatever, you know. And just the pressure of even making weight and the looking after your body afterwards. But yeah, it's unfortunate because it is a thing, like the menstrual cycle and female athletes is been talked about a lot more. I can see online and stuff, but I just feel like there's a lot of trainers that maybe don't know a lot, and they're just saying, you know, oh, at your time of the month, and they just think that the only time of the month is when you're bleeding. It doesn't occur to them that there's actually fluctuations at other times of the month. And say, for example, when you ovulate, your basal body temperature increases by about 1 degree, and that could affect, if you were getting into a sauna, you might go into heat stress a bit quicker. So we need to be aware of that, you know. But it's just a buzzword to say, oh, at your time of the month, don't do this, or at your time of the month. But they don't actually know what they're saying. What time of the month? Which is it? Ovulation? Menses?
Yeah. Let's clarify.
Lindsay, is the... Sorry if I sound ignorant, but is the nutrition, the actual nutrition plan, would it change if you're menstruating and in 5 weeks? Sorry if it's a stupid question.
It's a very valid question. And so what I would try to do would be, depending on the sport, obviously. So if we're talking MMA and we have a full day or more to recover, and 5 weeks generally I would take out some carbs. So the only carbs would be vegetables, so they wouldn't be having maybe rice or potatoes or whatever. But if you were going to be on your period that week, what we would do is diet a little harder for the 2 weeks previous and keep your carbs in, because you utilize carbs better then anyway. For a jiu-jitsu athlete, we would probably introduce some more heat acclimatization and actually just get you to try and sweat a bit more that week, so we could keep, because we need to keep your carbs for jiu-jitsu, you know. But again, we would be very selective with our carbs. It wouldn't be shy carbs, it'd be wholesome carbs that your body will suck up. We would time them correctly around your training, so that you can recover well and so that your body sucks them up. And then we would implement some sweating, some heat acclimatization, some passive heat though, like in a sauna or a bath or something like that. So basically, the more you get used to being in heat, the quicker your body will sweat. So that's why you might see that heat acclimatization with athletes and stuff out from fights. They start in a sauna like 8 weeks out to get their body better at sweating.
Wow. It's music in my ears. One more thing, completely unrelated. You've been through pregnancy and birth and postpartum. Do you work with people that are mothers?
Yeah, I do, yeah. Now, I don't claim to be a specialist in it, and that's a problem in the personal training industry, is people think because you've had a baby, you know everything. And it's the same way with what works for me on a wake-up might not work for you. So there's no cookie-cutter approach. So, but what I do is existing clients, and they're women, so they tend to have babies while they're with me. So I would have a good knowledge of postpartum and just healing of like diastasis recti after you've had a baby and getting the core back together. And then when specific things come up, I'm a good researcher, and I'm not afraid to say I don't know this and ring someone that does know it and find out from them, you know, like a good women's health physio or something can give me some guidance sometimes when things are a bit too complex. But yeah, I work with people, and a lot of people, of course, they come to me, they get pregnant, GP told them to stop training, blah, blah, blah. Like, and I spend my life telling people that their doctors are wrong.
Yeah. I mean, it seems, again, it's like doctors want to keep you well. And if that means, like, they're in a world that they don't understand, they're just like, well, I know that this is a safe space, so let's just keep you here, even though that's not really aligned with this person.
Well, the thing is, like, birth is such a physical feat. So you're about to do this very, very hard physical thing. So stop training. Or I could keep myself strong and in shape and have a good birth. And like what I always say to people is, don't decide to become a weightlifter when you get pregnant. Don't try to lose weight when you get pregnant. But if there's sports that you've been doing before you get pregnant, you should be fine to carry on, you know. And then obviously there's things in the gym that you would adjust in the first trimester. And then, like, I mean, I trained through my first pregnancy, I was kickboxing. I obviously wasn't sparring, but I was hitting pads and stuff. And then in my last pregnancy, I was training jiu-jitsu up till I was like 32 weeks.
Wow.
Just move. Just how? Use it as my cardio. How?
Let's go back there. How? What did you do? Who did you spar with? How did you do it?
Yeah. Well, initially, it was okay. Only that, like, when nobody knew I was pregnant, I was just very particular with who I would roll with. And I was very, very, I was ill. I was vomiting a lot. So my engine was terrible. So, but my coach, Dara O'Connell, he was really accommodating. I was just like, here, look, I'm pregnant, I'm going to be selective. And he was like, no, no problem. Like, whatever involves me not talking about pregnancy anymore, that's fine. Like, you work away, you know. So we done that. And then we're very lucky. We have a lot of girls in East Coast Jiu-Jitsu. So I there was never a struggle to find training partners. Austin, my other half, is a brown belt. So then when I got bigger, I actually just paired off with him. So if we went to a class and Dara was teaching something, that Austin and I would adjust it based on what I could actually do. And then rolling wise, I would only have a very select few people that I would roll with, and I would do our roll, and then I'd probably rest two or three because I'd be so wrecked, because your lung capacity is so vastly reduced. But I just wanted to keep moving. So I was going to one class and one open mat. And then the last time I went to the open mat on this Saturday, I was in bits for like 2 days, my hips and everything. So I just messaged Dara and I was like, okay, my body's told me it's time now. I'll see you on the other side.
And was that was, and how many weeks into that again was that?
About 32 wow. weeks.
Wow.
Yeah. But at that stage, I was just rolling with Austin. I was just playing top. Mm-hmm. And actually, I'm due. He was penting up a lot of rage. I'm due a good hiding now when I go back, because he couldn't really do much to me. He had to just let me, you know. And then I was trying to make use of my weight advantage that I never usually have.
Were you never scared of any move that could hurt?
No, I was just, so my main thing was not to fall over, basically. So I would just sit. As soon as the round started, I would just sit. And generally, like, that doesn't suit me, because I came from MMA to jiu-jitsu, so I like to wrestle and try and do a takedown. So people were really confused as, why is Lindsay pulling guard? She never pulls guard, you know. But I would just, so not, and no heavy sweeps. But really, I mean, once you're aware of your body and once your training partner's not an idiot, you generally know what's coming, you know. So obviously I would say to people, look, I'm pregnant. But you wouldn't even have to say it to the girls. Just like, no knee on belly, no crazy sweeps where you wrap up my arms with my lapel and I can't base for myself, you know. And if I felt I was being swept, I would just fall over, you know. It wasn't worth fighting. But the main thing was it gave me a good idea. Like, people come to jiu-jitsu and they're all shapes and sizes. And, like, literally by about maybe 16 weeks of pregnancy, my abs were just non-existent. And I was just thinking, how do people do that? Like, you just couldn't sit up or roll over, or, you know, that kind of way. And just when you have a body on top of you, it's just, you just need to be so strong in your core. And, you know, I take it for granted. And then there was the belly getting in the way. So then I had a new appreciation for people that are a bit larger doing jiu-jitsu, because I was just like, my belly's in the way of everything. Like, how do people do this?
How is this a beer belly?
Although I think beer bellies like squish and move. Mine was just solid watermelon placed on the front of the body.
Oh my god. Did your boobs not hurt when you were training, when they were growing?
No.
No.
No, not yet, but they will when I go back. Okay. Now if they're full of milk, they will. Like, I will tap to top pressure now while I'm feeding.
Really?
Also, when did you go back? I really want to talk about that. When was your return?
I haven't yet. So the baby's 5 weeks old. So what I'm going to do is, I'm lucky enough that Austin and I have our own gym, and we bought some mats during COVID. So I'm going to, for the next couple of weeks, I'm going to go and drill with him in the privacy of my own gym, so I can have any body related meltdowns in peace. And then when I feel like I might be able to do a round or two, I'll go back to East Coast. And again, like I did after Bodhi, I went back and I just eased my way in. Again, I was like not trying to beat anybody. I was just trying to move and be sensible. Because generally, if you get overtired, it affects your milk supply as well. So you just need to be conscious of that.
Oh, wow. I mean, I guess it makes sense.
And now you're doing weight.
Go on, Marina.
Are you doing any weight? Weight training?
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm just doing some, yeah. So I've been doing my rehab stuff basically on my core, and then just doing a few squats and pushes and pulls and stuff on top of it. Because weight training is a staple. Like, I love it. I do it twice a week religiously. I just feel like it's just really good for my mind anyway. I just feel like I always say, 20 kilos just always weighs 20 kilos. So whatever is going on in the world, it's me and the 20 kilos, and I can either lift it or I can't. In jiu-jitsu, you can go and you can be like, oh, they're having a great day, they're very well rested, it's not me that's shit, you know, or whatever, you know. Or like, you might be sleepy or whatever, but when you go to the gym, when I go to the gym to lift, it's very, very, like, 20 kilos is 20 kilos, it's 20 kilos last week, it's going to be 20 kilos next week. It hasn't got better in the last week since I trained with it, you
absolutely
know?
I mean, did you train weights throughout the whole of your pregnancy? Was that something that you managed to keep up?
Yeah. Yeah. So you just adjust as you go, you know. So I could feel, again, just being conscious of my body and like knowing my body. So, for example, I think at about 20 weeks, I started feeling my hips were moving. And so my track in my lunges wasn't right. So I just stuck then with squats. I didn't do any single leg stuff because I didn't want to upset my pelvis any more than the baby was going to. Things like when you get to a certain level of bigness, you don't want to be lying flat because then the bump comes up onto your lungs. You can't really breathe very well. So you would just incline your stuff. Very early on in pregnancy, you wouldn't be training abs because you just... I'm not actually sure that that's a thing, but it's a thing. You know, I don't know if you could crunch the baby out of you, but people don't want to train abs. And I don't know enough about it to argue, you know?
I mean, I think that's... what. How are you doing... like, how did you approach your stomach retraining in your core after your baby was born? Was that something that was different?
Yeah, well, so the first time around, I was really naive. I thought I'd be back in shape straight away. I was in the gym squatting the day before I had him. I was like, this will be fine, I'll be back. And I remember he was about 10 days old and I went to the gym and I was trying to do a plank and I just couldn't do like 10 seconds and I was so upset. And then I was like, actually, this is legit, you know. So this time around, I'm going in way kinder to myself. So I've been doing pelvic floor and small walks with the buggy. And only last week I started doing some transverse abs exercises. So some toe taps and toe weeks. It's just all really basic stuff to just activate your deep inner core.
Mm-hmm. Well, is there, do you think there's enough information available for women who are in recovery? Or do you think that's still an area that needs to, I mean, in recovery, like from that, the crazy physicalness of birth?
Yeah.
Do you think there's stuff?
I
don't know.
I think there's plenty. I think there's stuff out there if you wanted for general ladies, but I think for athletes, female athletes, no, mm-hmm. there's not. You know, because it's all rest, take it easy. Sure, you're a mom now. You don't need to be doing all that stuff. You know, that kind of way, and that's just not realistic for people that, even not even high level athletes, just people that train, and it's a part of their week, a part of their mental health strategy, part of their person. You know, part of their identity. Especially, it really annoys me when you see people having a baby and the man maintains his hobbies, but the woman drops hers, you know, it's just really not good. So I think, yeah, doing, you know, your postpartum forever, as they say, there's a few Instagram accounts that I follow that are like postpartum athlete, and they're really good. So they do give you the timeline to be doing. You have to do the basic stuff that I'm talking about. And if you skip it, like I noticed on Bodhi, I skipped that. I didn't really take it seriously. But then when my squats kind of got back heavy enough, I could really feel a lacking in my core at the bottom to try and help me up out of the squat. So I was like, okay, I need to address this. You know, I'm going to hurt myself. But other people might not know that and they just think, oh, I'm not strong anymore. I've had a baby,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we're going to close and ask our final question, which essentially is... your motivation, your drive, you're a very powerful woman, you've achieved so much, and there has to be something pushing you and driving you. Like, so what are you fighting for?
Well, at the minute, having a daughter has definitely really laser focused my focus. But generally, for me, my passions are for female athletes to get what's theirs, to be treated as good as men, male athletes, to be able to reach their full potential. And I mean that in a way that for us as women to go and get it, to not take no for an answer and to push on and to, you know, all the information's out there. So go find it, educate yourself and go get what's yours, basically, you know.
Wow. Lovely. And where can people find you? I think this is a good thing to say. What's your...
Yeah, they can find me on Instagram. It's Female Fight Nutritionist, or the website is femalefightnutritionist.com, or if you're interested in the S&C side of things, it's Improve Grappling on Instagram or improvegrappling.com.
Lovely. Thank you so much. That was amazing.
No worries. That was great. Thanks, Emil.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Women Who Fight podcast, and credit to Will Grant for being our songwriter and sound editor. Please subscribe and share and follow us on Facebook and Instagram at womenwhofight.co.uk and check out our website for more content.